2 Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. I'm Professor Larry Jacobs. I direct the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota School of Public Affairs, and we are sponsoring today's conversation. Before we begin, just a quick set of instructions to help you along here. You'll see at the bottom of your screen, there's a Q&A button, and we want to encourage you to use that to submit questions. Give us any kind of question you want. We welcome questions that go in new directions or raise challenges. All that is good. And we're going to get to as many as possible. There's also a button at the bottom of the screen called Live Transcript. And that allows us to give live captioning for anyone who wants that. So please take advantage of both of those. The Center for the Study of Politics and Governance has got some very exciting upcoming programs, and I just want to take a moment to mention them to you. We've heard a lot about the intense interest of voters, particularly primary voters, in the 2024 election. What about the folks who are not interested in politics or only peripherally interested? We're going to have a great conversation with several of the best scholars on that coming up April 2nd. We're going to have our second Nagasaki Dialogue conversation. The first was with the New York Times' Tom Friedman. And the next one coming up on April 22nd is with former U.S. Senator Rob Portman. We're going to be talking about how to build bipartisan legislation, how to bring people together. Rob Portman has had an extraordinary record in Washington and doing that at a very difficult time. So there's a lot there to pick up on. April 29th, Anna Greenberg, one of the premier pollsters and political consultants, can be with us, talk about the power of women voters in 2024. So lots coming up. Please join us for those conversations. And now that brings us to today's conversation, one of the most important. Science was once a topic on which Democrats and Republicans agreed. It wasn't even really a political issue. Sure, there were disputes and so forth, but about the value of science and its importance to the progress in the country, there was just a lot of agreement. No longer. Whether it's COVID or and COVID vaccinations or climate change, there is now a sharp partisan disagreement over science. And today's terrific guests are going to be discussing why that has happened. James Druckmann, who's a professor at University of Rochester in the Political Science Department. Professor Druckmann is remarkably prolific. He's also touched on a wide range of topics, really one of the most important scholars in the area of public opinion and political psychology. And we're delighted to have Professor Druckmann with us today. Also joining us as our moderator is Carrie Funk, who was the past director of research on science and society at the Pew Research Center. She is now the senior advisor for the Aspen Institute's Science and Society Program. Let me turn things over to Dr. Carrie Funk. Thank you both.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here. This is going to be a great opportunity to hear directly from Jamie Druckmann, who, as you said, you know, we're all interested in kind of looking behind the published articles to get a sense of what you see going on. I'm going to start the ball rolling, and then I'll start adding in questions that are on the Q&A chat board. So I want to just start with something Larry touched on. You know, why are we talking about the threat to science from politics? You know, do you see this as a real threat? you know, and kind of why are we talking about it now? What's been changing?
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for having me. And it's really a pleasure to be here today. And so, yeah, I think Larry and Carrie, your kind of follow up really touches on a vital issue. I think a good starting point is through the conversation for the next hour is to remember that trust in science relative to trust in other institutions is remarkably high. And so we have to kind of always kind of keep that in the back of the mind as we embark on a kind of a conversation on why we should be concerned potentially about the levels of trust in science. And so I just want to start with kind of that baseline to keep in mind. You know, it's kind of there's the military, there's medical establishment, there's scientists, and that's always higher than basically any other societal institution or actor. That said, as Larry indicated in his introductory remarks, if we go back in time, if we go back to the 1970s, in fact, there was a bit of a gap between the Democrats and Republicans. But the Republicans were the ones who exhibited a bit more trust in science. The gap wasn't large. It wasn't highly politicized. You'd get topics, as Larry intimated, where you'd have political battles. But, you know, it was largely something that was not a hotly political issue. You know, this changed a little bit with the emergence of abortion as a political issue, for example. But you know, even by the turn of the century in 2000, if you look at data, you would see Republicans and Democrats that at that point they had kind of equaled out. So the average Democrat and the average Republican had about the same trust in science as a general matter in the scientific community. What you've seen since then, though, is this kind of emergence of this large chasm between Democrats and Republicans. And I think the reason for concern then is not necessarily the level of trust or distrust per se, but rather if we think about from a political or governance perspective, right, you need entities who are running the government to interact with one another, and they have to come to some compromise and agreement on different things. And in doing that, they have to rely on certain types of information. They delegate to certain types of informative sources. And scientists have historically been an important part of that. They play a fundamental role in advising public policy. The government invests a lot of money in scientific research. You can think of science as a public good in some sense. And so to the extent that partisans start to divide over whether or not the scientific community is providing worthwhile or credible information, it becomes a problem for how we're going to govern with one another. And you know, I can elaborate further if you'd like. I can kind of go on kind of why did this chasm start to emerge? Is that a good direction to kind of continue?
Well, let me back you up first and then we'll keep going on the chasm. I mean, because this is great. This is a big you know, long time frame, trying to think about the big picture. I mean, my first question is there just something different about the salience of science issues now? You said, you know, there was very little political divide back in the 70s. Is that because we weren't really talking about it in civic issues?
Yeah, I mean, I that's a great question. I mean, I think in some sense, I will get, when we talk about the evolution, it's hard to not interject climate change in this conversation, because that obviously plays a salient role in kind of the politicization of science over time. But I think even putting climate change aside, I think there has been some politicalization of science. And I say that, you know, in two senses. In one sense, I think there's been a general politicalization of kind of societal conversations and discussions as a general matter. Politics now creeps over into areas of life that used to be kind of immune from political discussions. And in that sense, politics or science is not unlike other domains of life. You know, we see in the workplace, we see kind of there's much more political tensions than there used to be, for example. In the second sense, that, you know, I think kind of cultural issues that have kind of evolved, and I already kind of mentioned abortion as one, which, you know, I think starting in kind of the early 1970s and kind of how the parties reacted to abortion, which itself is an interesting story, has played a role in elevating in science as part of the public conversation. And then I think this has become even more salient in two other senses. One is the extent to which scientists have become more visible as in the public policy domain. It's been a kind of a very interesting dynamic, which I think is still kind of evolving. In one regard, people have greater trust for scientists when they are more applied, as you showed in your own work, Carrie. But in another sense, I think people have some suspicion when scientists overstep. And so there's a bit of a tension in that regard. And so I think, you know, scientists have become more visible in that regard. Scientists have become somewhat more outspoken, I think, in some senses. And in another way, you know, it's hard to disassociate kind of the role of science and the politicalization of science with kind of attitudes towards the education sector today, and kind of education has become politicized as well. And, you know, that's kind of bundled into kind of the politicalization of science as well. You know, I think also as you yourself have shown, you know, distrust in, you know, particularly climate science leads to lower trust in kind of higher education. And so, you know, there's been kind of a variety of these forces at work, which have helped contribute to this divide.
That's great. Let's just pick up on that thread since we're here at a university. There'll be people interested in that. You know, where is that coming from? Why do you say that the trust in educational institutions or higher ed in particular might be intertwined with trust in science?
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit, you know, I think there's at least two dynamics going on. You know, one is, you know, the composition of people who work in higher education have historically and continue to be kind of on one side of the political divide. It's generally a liberal population, largely speaking. And so, you know, I think in that sense, there has long been a kind of a latent and sometimes active suspicion of higher education. And so, you know, it's not the first time higher education has been, you know, quote unquote, under attack, you know, from different societal sectors. So I think that's one thing that's gone on. You know, another is kind of just the alignment of people with one partisan side and another. And particularly, you know, historically, people with lower education were either divided between the parties, or perhaps they were even slightly more on the Democratic side. And so to the extent that higher education was populated by people with liberal leanings, that didn't necessarily charge kind of into a political fight, because you had kind of people with lower education kind of on both sides of the spectrum. As people with lower education have kind of sorted into the Republican Party and people with higher education have sorted into the Democratic Party, you're seeing a much starker educational divide between the parties, which makes higher education an obvious kind of point of that divide, and kind of what is the role of higher education, not only as a knowledge provider, but also as kind of how necessary it is for, you know, mobility and kind of civic health of the country, and kind of what exactly is the role of higher education. And, you know, given that it's a knowledge production entity, it also then is kind of mixed in with science. You know, that's where basic research gets done. And so you can't just separate them in that sense.
All right, that's fantastic. So yeah, we've already covered a lot of territory here. I want to try to go back a little bit about, I think the first takeaway that I was hearing is that you're kind of saying that politics has changed more than science. You know, you've done a lot of work on this. So you want to just talk a little bit about what's changed in the political landscape. Why are we so divided in the first place? Yeah. And then that's bleeding over into all sorts of science issues.
Yeah, it's such a great question, and it's such a fascinating dynamic, because I'll tell you the story that I'm finding in data that I have looked at, which, you know, is quite striking and was somewhat surprising, the consistency of that. And so there is the best time series data, that is, if you want to chart kind of over time confidence in science, there's a national survey called the General Social Survey that has been going on since 1972. It's kind of the major sociological survey, but it's kind of widely used to chart kind of societal institutions and belief. And they've been measuring confidence in science since then. And so you can go back to the early 1970s and you can say, who was trusting, who had confidence in science at that point in time? And what you'd find is that you'd find so these are the people who are not high in confidence in science. People who are religious, people who are lower educated, people from rural backgrounds, people from lower class, people from not non-white, people of color. And, you know, kind of, you can then jump ahead and you can take their 2020 data and you can run those same types of analyses looking at who's more or less confident in science. And it is exactly the same individuals. So kind of who is trusting and not trusting of science has remained remarkably stable in, you know, over the past 50 or more years. And I can talk a little bit later about why that might be, but kind of that would move a little bit out of the political domain, although I think it's quite an important topic if we have time. But how did this then kind of, if that's remained stable, it raises this question, well, why did the political divide emerge? And I'll mention two things I think occurred. One is, you know, as I kind of suggested earlier on when I talked about kind of what happened to people with lower or higher education, you saw many of those groups that I just mentioned kind of evolved into affiliating with different parties. So if you think of the rural population, you know, over time, they've gravitated to the Republican Party. If you think of the lower class population, you know, they were probably much, much more composed of Democrats, and they have kind of evolved over time to the Republican Party. As I mentioned, education, if you think of lower educated people, they've evolved over time to the Republican Party. And, the, you know, I don't mean to kind of just make it sound like this is a Republican story. Kind of the inverse of that is that, you know, the other, their counterparts have moved to the Democratic Party. So what was once these social groups, for reasons that I think are largely orthogonal to politics, although I'm going to come back and have a caveat to that in a moment. But for some reasons, you know, that are orthogonal to politics, have lower high confidence in science, they've kind of separated themselves into parties. And so the parties now are representing these cleavages that were there, but now they are part of politics. And so we suddenly have this divide. And so I think that's one of the things that's gone on. The other thing is this has been accelerated, and it's been accelerated by politics itself. And this is where you have to bring in climate change, right? If you go back even to the 1990s, there was really not a public divide on environmental issues or climate change, so to speak. You know, and that really changed. And, you know, even in Congress, it wasn't until kind of the early 90s or late 80s that you saw kind of members of different parties voting differently on environmental legislation. And that really changed. And you saw climate change become kind of the quintessential scientific issue. It became an issue that divided the parties. You saw a lot of this was kind of, there was a lot of think tanks and organizations that were kind of engaging in active kind of political campaigns to shape opinions and policy around climate, you know, backed on the one hand by kind of fossil fuel industry, and on the other side by environmental groups. They aligned with the parties. And so it's very hard to kind of separate out climate change from this general story and the politics around climate change. And that kind of activated the partisan divide even further. So you saw this partisan divide on climate change for potentially material or kind of moral reasons. But then that kind of becomes such a salient issue that it then morphs into kind of general feelings about science. And then you saw this perfect storm, which you pointed out really eloquently when we talked previously, Carrie, when COVID hit. Right? COVID, kind of going into COVID, when COVID first started, there wasn't an a priori reason to think that this would become a deeply divided partisan issue. But given that we were already kind of moving in this kind of stark partisan divide on science because of these social sorting phenomenon, the social sorting phenomenon that I pointed out before, combined with the evolution of climate change politics, you kind of then got to COVID, and it became this extremely politicized, activated issue, you know, all over the world to some extent, but, you know, most strongly, I think, in this country, at least in terms of overall performance in kind of the divides that we saw. And so, yeah, okay. I think that's kind of the...
Yeah. Okay, this is fascinating. And there's... I think a couple of points. One, I'm glad we finally brought up COVID, because it's kind of the elephant in the room in terms of talking about long-term trends. What about our most recent situation? The one thing I'm hearing is there is a way in which we're using the same words, Republican and Democrat, but the coalitions of who is a Democrat and a Republican today has changed a lot. You talked about education in particular. My memory was around 2008 when Obama was getting elected president. That's when we really saw the higher education kind of split off, where people with a graduate degree or more were very clearly aligned with the Democratic candidate. And then from that time on, we kept talking about it. So just to give you a little bit of context there, climate change. Yes, like the key, as you, the quintessential science issue of the era. But for a long time in science circles that I was talking in, we thought it was kind of isolated. That yes, there's climate change and there's debate over climate, but it wasn't all of science. And that there was a kind of a bubble around those conversations that wasn't affecting everything. Is there a correction to take away from that, or a next direction from there?
Yeah. Thank you on the 2008. I think that's right. On climate change, that's a really fascinating way to put it. And I can kind of remember back. You know, I wasn't having the same conversations at the same time, I think, but that's a really interesting kind of characterization. And you know, I can kind of see that in thinking back. And I think one of the lessons to take out of that is, you know, I kind of initially put a lot of weight on the coalitional social dynamics underlying this. And, you know, again, it's important to kind of not remove the role of the political actors specifically. And to the extent that climate change became so defining, I think there was a lot of political ammunition at work, you know, as has been kind of well documented, probably most notably by a great book, The Merchants of Doubt, by Naomi Oreskes and Conway, kind of showing how climate change fueled kind of particularly on the right, but, you know, on the left, there were environmental groups as well, but particularly on the right, think tanks who were, you know, quite actively engaging in campaigns of climate misinformation. And it became, such a salient political issue that at some point, and you could probably pinpoint the timing much better than I, you know, it became kind of what people thought about when I think when you. So one of the questions that I think inevitably comes up, which is a really important question, is I earlier referred to the general social survey data. And as, you know, throughout this conversation so far, we've talked about trust in science and trust in scientists. What does that mean? What are people thinking about when you ask them about that? You know, I can say with pretty strong certainty that in 1973, they weren't thinking about climate scientists. but today, I imagine that a non-trivial, if not vast majority of people, when you ask that, at some point, somewhere in the recesses of their mind, they're thinking about climate scientists. And so I think that kind of evolution of you know, kind of is kind of literal micro level dynamic of kind of, as you described it, climate changing kind of morphing into what we think about science. It might have literally done so in people's minds and may have spilt over into how they think of science in general. It's, you know, that's a conjecture, not a documented dynamic.
Yeah, we won't hold you to that. We got some conjectures coming here because we want to get to some things that are probably beyond what you can do in the data. We got some questions coming in the Q&A, so appreciate that. Keep it coming. One somewhat paraphrased version really is okay, climate change associated with the left-leaning side of things. Is science inherently a left-leaning topic, do you think? You know, is there something that could shift the kind of political divides we're seeing now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the it's a great question. And I think kind of for scholars, when they talk, you know, I don't want to get into a conversation about kind of a misinformation per se, but as an example, when scholars kind of are studying misinformation, sometimes when they're talking about scientific misinformation, they have to kind of try to scramble to find examples that are kind of on the left, which, you know, is largely because they're so consumed with climate change and then COVID, not because they don't exist, which is the reason I'm saying that. And yeah, I think it is not an inherently kind of ideological thing in terms of, you know, again, if we go back to like the 1970s, there were significant gaps with Republicans being more trusting in science than Democrats, and conservatives being more trusting in science than liberals. And I think at that point in time, you know, I don't know what was in people's minds, but I imagine that they may have been thinking about things like space scientists, you know, different types of scientists. And so, you know, I don't think so. I don't think it's an inherently ideological issue, but I do think that there is an inherent, to the extent that education has flipped, you know, on those categories that I mentioned before, right? I mentioned earlier, religiosity, I mentioned urban-rural, I mentioned race and ethnicity. I mentioned education. I mentioned class, and we can throw in gender as well. Two of those categories, religiosity and education, are kind of intrinsically tied to science insofar as, you know, when you're using science, scientists are almost always a pretty educated group of people. And so, you know, education is kind of part of science. And there is, you know, a longstanding tension between religiosity and science. And, you know, for better or worse, that tension is there. I think it's not, it's a tension that can be overcome to some extent. You know, for those of you who follow Francis Collins, who was the director of NIH, who is now no longer the director of NIH, and I think is spending much of his time trying to dispel ideas that science and religion are incompatible. But for better or worse, I think there is a tension there. And to the extent that Democrats have become the educated party and Republicans the less educated party, and then we have this secular surge, which is the kind of enormous kind of growth of non-religious people, most of them identifying with the Democratic Party, you kind of end up with this partisan divide. So that was a very long-winded way to say, I don't think there's anything inherent in the ideologies or even the parties per se, but I think in this point in time, that's what we're seeing.
All right, that's great. It's somewhat ironic as the population becomes more and more educated, but we're seeing a very strong divide along political lines, and really it's a barrier for making science more inclusive.
Yes.
So, okay. And I think, all right. So, sorry, I'm losing track because there's so many directions to go. I did want to push you on. You don't want to talk about misinformation, but you should talk about misinformation.
Two things about. I didn't want to get into a whole misinformation seminar, but
But I mean, I think it's a piece of what you've talked about, and also just maybe more broadly, you mentioned accelerating, and is the information environment we live in part of what's accelerating these political divides?
Yeah, that's such a great question, and you know, it's such a difficult question to answer because you know we have so much more data on the extent of misinformation than we used to have. So you know, I think there's two points. One is just kind of a really fascinating thing. If we go back to the Spanish flu, right in 1918, 1919, there was an article published in the journal Science, which is kind of the preeminent science journal. And there was it was by one of the kind of a government official who had played a large role in kind of overseeing the governmental response to the Spanish flu. And he cited in this article, almost in these words, you know, misinformation was rampant around the Spanish flu. And so there's certainly nothing new about misinformation. What is new about misinformation is our ability to track it. We can track it at a much higher rate than we could before. But that also means that it perfuses at a much higher rate than it did before. And it's been discussed at a much higher rate than it did before. And so it's very difficult to study because, in some sense, you have to kind of try to get a handle and control the entire information ecosystem. But, you know, I think on its face, it's a little bit hard to kind of put aside that that kind of the media kind of environment hasn't kind of accelerated some of the divides that we're seeing. They've created information ecosystems to some extent. I think that that's certainly played a role in kind of some of the divides that we have seen around science. And, you know, I don't think the WHO, you know, they characterized with the COVID pandemic, they characterized the word infodemic, which is meant kind of, you know, a pandemic of information or misinformation. And, you know, I don't think they take such a step lightly. So I think that it certainly is playing a role. And, you know, we certainly saw a lot of misinformation being sorted through COVID. You know, I think some people who try to minimize the impact of misinformation kind of try to talk about, well, the effects aren't necessarily large. You know, I think we saw during COVID, you know, even if the majority of the population is not following up on kind of misperceptions, you know, enough people seem to be that it was leading to kind of maladaptive health behaviors, you know, particularly in this country, like, you know, beliefs about vaccines kind of being then correlated with not getting vaccinated you know, it was quite palatable in that sense. So, you know, I think it clearly had kind of, you know, life-saving implications in that case.
Yeah, I mean, it was so complicated if you think about COVID as an example, because
yeah.
literally nobody knew what was happening and how it was spread at first, and didn't know what to do and how to handle it. And people who were smart people yeah. who were trying to figure out what to yeah. do said it was confusing. And why would yeah. it be confusing, right? So it's like there was so
yeah,
much.
Yeah,
it,
yeah.
it shows you how hard it is to be a caring citizen and trying to learn and make sense of what's solid information and what's not solid. It really yeah. is a tricky business.
And then how to communicate it. I mean, right? You know, I think there was, you know, I was going to use the word communication missteps, but that's probably not a fair word. There were, you know, in retrospect, they were missteps. But, you know, as time unfolded so quickly, it was difficult. But, you know, I think there were a lot of lessons learned about how to communicate public health through COVID.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about that, because the Humphrey School's own Peter Callow published an op-ed in the Star Tribune last week and kind of was making a point about really how evidence-based policy making maybe needs to make a distinction between the evidence base and the policy making. And he saw policy making as more rooted in values. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I love the editorial. I highly recommend it to anybody tuning in, because it's a really thorny issue. I think in the ideal abstract, I certainly agree. I think scientists researchers need to be quite careful in stepping into the policy domain. They have to kind of at least recognize the role of their values when they're kind of entering that domain. But at the same time, you know, I think there are two other things to keep in mind. One is, you know, at some point when we're doing science, kind of it's inevitable that values are playing some role in the questions that we're asking and how we're going about it. So we need to be conscious of that as well. The question then is, when do those values, you know, they're affecting our science somewhat, we are cognizant of that, when are they going to be, is that different than affecting kind of using science in the policy domain? I think that's a little tricky. I think the other question is, you know, coming back to something I cited before from your own work, Carrie, you know, insofar as people do like more applied researchers, more applied scientists, they have higher credibility. But the caveat to that is they are also more kind of polarizing, right? Democrats in particular like applied scientists more than Republicans. And so what role should they play? And one of the reasons I love the editorial is because it took a clear position, and I think a very defensible one. It articulated that very well. It would generate a conversation along the lines I'm talking about. And it's an important conversation for policymakers and kind of how do policymakers who want to use evidence-based policy or use evidence-based medicine, kind of where do the policymakers kind of start and end, and where does the researchers start and end, and how do they manage those relationships in a transparent manner, I think is really important. And then on the other side, I think, you know, not to get into the weeds, but kind of in higher education today, you know, more and more what I'm seeing is kind of amongst scientists in the physical sciences and the medical sciences and the social sciences, there is a lot more weight put on kind of how to communicate your science to a public, in a public facing manner. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, that has a lot of positive attributes, right? We want to communicate the knowledge that we have in a good way, and we want to empower scientists to do that. But you know, at what point do you kind of draw parameters around that, and so that scientists aren't overstepping their own expertise, aren't imputing their own values into the science that they're communicating? And so I think that there's a question for the policymaking side, and there's also a question for the scientist side, and kind of not only when they enter the policymaking domain, but also even when they're just not just, but when they are communicating to a public audience, you know, how do they manage that? And, you know, that's a question that has not come up enough. You know, there's a lot of energy into kind of encouraging researchers to be more communicative in a public facing manner, mm-hmm. which, there's so much energy around that that sometimes I think it's forgotten that you need to be careful in communicating as well.
The wise words. Let's circle back to trust in science a little more directly, because there's just so much conversation around that in the science community writ large. So can you say a little more about why trust in science is important for scientists or other institutions, as the case may be? What does it matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's best to kind of stand back and think about what trust means. What is trust? What does it mean to trust somebody? And, at the most fundamental kind of basis, I think trust is about being vulnerable. You're basically opening yourself up to kind of following somebody else's advice, delegating to somebody else to get knowledge or information or following what they suggest. And you're putting your well-being in jeopardy when you're doing that. Whether that's kind of in the health domain, whether it's kind of getting your car fixed, whether it's kind of going to school and kind of, you're trusting educators. We do this all the time. We kind of are choosing to trust certain entities and not other entities. And so when we do that, we are assuming that those entities have our interests at heart, that they're not going to kind of undermine our interests. So we can talk about trust as a general matter as being kind of fundamental for kind of how we operate in society. And then scientists have this particularly unique role, right? Scientists, as empowered by governments, in the United States, this was probably made initially, you could go back to George Washington talking about the importance of investing in science, but, made most kind of clear with the founding under the Lincoln administration of the National Academy of Sciences, which was it's a non-government entity, but it is there to be a scientific advisory to the government. And so, in the investment of science, science is seen as a way to generate knowledge that should be valuable to the public writ large. And so, to the extent that science is a good that should be beneficial, it only will do that if people trust it. If people don't trust it, they are not going to follow that advice. And so it becomes a bad investment if it's producing knowledge nobody pays attention to. And so in that sense, it's quite fundamental that we have trust. And going back to kind of the first thing that I said, that is why it is important to remember that even when we talk about kind of low or high trust, the low trusting people, two points. One is the low trusting people are generally not that low trusting when we compare it to like other institutions. Nearly everybody loves scientists versus politicians. Or media.
To your point, isn't this a rather low bar? We're sitting here right in an era of low trust in institutions. Sure. So yeah, trust in scientists is a little bit higher than the media or politicians.
Right. Yes. But it's, people are using science there are a few people who are ignoring science entirely. And then it is important to kind of think about the other side. We don't want kind of unencumbered trust in anything. We don't want unencumbered trust in science. That would, kind of undermine the whole point of science, which is to kind of question and kind of, explore and recognize that you never have a certain answer to anything.
Underscore that, because that's the perfect segue. Let's talk about kind of the trust for democracy and for society writ large, and then we'll come back to what can go wrong for groups with lower trust. Because so many people in the science community, they sometimes sound as if they want blind trust, that they want just deference to their authority, which was a little different than the way you described it as a role to generate knowledge for the public good. So go ahead and explain a little bit more about what the limits might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think from just if we think about what science is as a process, it's a knowledge generating process where you produce kind of insights that are accord with a certain hypothesis, and then you kind of continue to believe that is the case until you disprove it. And so in that sense, you never have obtained absolute truth when you're producing science. And so that then kind of, that's pretty simple. That's like fifth grade, like let's learn the scientific method. You don't prove anything with science. You kind of only disprove. So that's a pretty easy point to make. So to me, that raises the question of why is there kind of And I couldn't agree with you more that there is certainly a kind of a energy or kind of a feeling amongst certain segments of the scientific population, like, oh, you should just know what I know, and then you should just do what I do. I think part of that is a lack of an appreciation that ultimately there is a difference between kind of science as a piece of information that people bring into their head when they're making a decision, and then what they do with that information. And let me clarify that a little bit, right? So let's think about COVID. And so if we think about COVID and you're talking to a scientist who was studying COVID, they would have said, I shouldn't say any, a caricature would be, right, okay, I have learned that COVID is a respiratory disease that can be quite deadly. And you really should not get into contact with other people. And therefore your decision should be to stay at home and follow a stay at home order. And that's the decision. And anybody who doesn't follow that advice is stupid. And that's that. And that's the scientific statement. But then you can imagine kind of the plight of somebody who might be kind of, living in poverty, potentially kind of trying to make ends meet. They are a frontline worker. They're living in a state where it's not completely shut down, perhaps. And their choice is kind of, I can stay at home, or I can go and try to kind of make some amount of living. It puts my health at risk, potentially. But this is what I have to do to provide for myself, to provide for my family. And in that case, they may or may not, but they very well may kind of be completely trusting of the science, but their decision will not be in accordance with what the scientists said. And that's a case where scientists are potentially overstepping. Obviously the pandemic is a crisis situation, so I understand that. But, stepping out of that crisis, that's a case where scientists may have been overstepping to recognize that, scientific information is one stream of information that people might use in making decisions. And so we need to be very careful to differentiate science as a information versus science as a decision. And, so I think that's an important distinction. And then I also think you have to remember that kind of what follows from that is just giving people kind of endless scientific information is not going to lead them to then take a certain action. People are not kind of just kind of repositories of information that just need to be kind of fueled with scientific data. They're going to be kind of thinking about this in concert with a lot of other considerations. And so, I just think it's a naive perspective to think, A, that it is normatively desirable to always follow, what the current state of science states, especially because science changes over time. And then kind of from a real just positive perspective, that's just not how people are going to operate. And I think recognition of that would, in fact, although it might sound, somebody listening might sound like, I might come across as somebody who's casting doubt about the importance of science, but I think in my mind, kind of recognition of those realities actually could empower science to having a larger role, because you're kind of recognizing its limits is a way to kind of leverage its kind of possibilities.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always put myself in, the general other people's shoes is basically what I try to do as a survey researcher. And you're reminding me of kind of one of the puzzles when you ask people about different sources of information and what they rely on and basically who they turn to. They'll say good things about relying on scientific experts about some topic or other, but they also talk about their close friends and family. And eventually I unpacked it as like, okay, so many people say, I rely on my personal network. And when you hear them talk, what they're really saying is, I can trust these people have my interests at heart. And it doesn't that kind of circle back to trust, right? And that there's a way in which that personal connection is, it's a real trust, and there's a more general feeling about trust in scientific experts, but it's not as deep.
Yeah. So that's fantastic. And I think that kind of means, so first that, yes, absolutely. It's perfectly reasonable and rational that you would trust the people who you know best and are in your networks, that they have your interests at heart. And that then cycles back to kind of why are the groups that I talked about earlier, those demographic groups that I characterized in a certain fashion as kind of having this longstanding relative distrust of science. And part of that is if you think about how do we form our social networks? We often form our social networks around people who are like ourselves. And so people tend to associate and kind of interact with people who are like them demographically, right? It's fairly homogenous, demographically speaking. What that means is that people in those groups, they're in those distrusting groups for a reason. And the really fascinating thing is, if we look at the population of scientists and we think about what characterized their demographics, they exactly are the inverse of the people who are low trusting, right? So who are some of those low trusting groups, right? So kind of by education, almost by definition, right? Scientists are educated, so low educated people are probably, to the extent that they're associating with people like them, not interacting as much with scientists. What about people lower class? Lower class individuals, scientists tend to be from kind of more higher socioeconomic backgrounds. In fact, it's quite striking. Something like upwards of 70% of scientists are second generation college students or more. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, I this might be not exactly right, but I think it's more like 40 to 50% of the population right about now. The gap is large. And so they're not, you know, when you're kind of socioeconomically speaking, you're also not going to be as kind of in the social networks of scientists. We can do the same thing with religiosity. We can do the same thing with rural urban. And so you're not surrounded by scientists. You're more socially distant by science. You're not represented in science. And so you're going to be less trusting of science. You're going to trust science more if a scientist, if one of those persons who's your family and friends is a scientist. And so, you know, it percolates in that way. And so, you know, I think that kind of cycles back to that.
I think that's really interesting. So to me, I'm hearing that's one implication then for really for a broader level of trust over time is to finally address the underrepresentation of all of these people and groups in the halls of science. You know, and there's a way in which the U.S. population is becoming more and more diverse, but not the people who are working in science or other STEM professions. So yes. small amounts of progress, but certainly not the kind of bigger change that is necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think a couple points on that. You know, it hasn't changed substantially, and to the extent that it would be useful for it to change. We know that it would be useful for it to change insofar as we know people like, if we think about how this is probably most documented in kind of the health domain, but we know people are much more likely to follow the advice of their primary care physician when their primary care physician looks like them. And so, you know, there was just a paper that came out that showed this with gender, that women are much more likely to feel trusting of their physician when it's a woman. We certainly know that about race. And, you know, particularly with race, for good reason. You know, there's well-documented kind of biases in the medical system. You know, there's long historic biases in science based on race and ethnicity. And so, you know, for good reason, diversifying science would have that effect. It is important to say, when we talk about diversifying science, that's over multiple dimensions, right? We, you know, when we talk about kind of diversification in higher education, you know, diversifying science and higher education, you know, we put a lot of stress, you know, which for good reason, on gender and race. But, you know, we also should be thinking about class and rural background, religiosity, to the extent that you can kind of operationalize that. So, you know, it's a broad diversification. You know, I think sometimes some of these initiatives kind of start to sound like it's leaning in one political direction or another, but it's really a broad diversification, which would be most useful.
Okay, that's really interesting. And I think part of it is this idea of I forget how you put it, but if you think about it as many people who are in science, they are interested in making science more accessible to people, what people call engagement with science. So if you think about ourselves on a continuum, coming to a program like this is like, no, okay, it's a kind of low bar, but we're engaging with concepts related to science. And, you know, the more extreme version is to devote your life to it and make that be your life's work. So, you know, so I think what I'm hearing is this idea of we need to diversify all aspects of science, from working in science as well as, you know, making it more accessible for people across rural communities, across religious communities, across racial and ethnic groups. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I do think, you know, kind of on a positive note, to the extent that that is important, which I think it is, you know, there are a lot of efforts being made along those lines. There are a lot of what I think they're coined bridging communities, bridging organizations who try to bridge the practice of science with local communities and making sure that science reaches local communities and does so in a way that is kind of consistent with local culture and kind of recognizing kind of how science is used by those communities, and also incorporating those local communities in the data collection of science itself, which I think is an important part of it as well. You know, especially coming back to kind of medical science as an example, you know, there's a long and continuing history of many groups being very underrepresented as data points in the collection of scientific data. You know, it was historically mostly white men who were what we know about in terms of health. And so, you know, not only incorporating broader diversity within kind of the practice and kind of the communication of science, but also kind of as the people being studied and kind of the considerations being given as well.
Well, I think related to that we haven't quite touched on is just the idea of what is scientists' responsibility and what in lower levels of trust, especially with these communities, you know, presumably at some level. Yeah. Their actions matter, right? Whether as an individual or as a system or as a set of individuals and institutions. I don't know if there's a question in there, but yeah. You referenced it.
Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, just as we talked earlier about kind of this difficult terrain to navigate between science and policy, I think an equally difficult terrain to kind of figure out is that relationship between science, we could throw policy in there as well, and kind of local communities, you know, however, whatever local community we want to talk about. And kind of, if you're trying to communicate science to a community, you know, how do you figure out kind of what is your responsibility as a scientist to that community, and how to kind of best do your job as a scientist, but also kind of communicate that science to the community. And I think that's it's a challenge. And you know,
can you bring the politics back into that? Because that's where we started, right? But okay, we're going to talk about science, but we're divided about science and we're here on a dialogue across difference. So what can we do to better talk to each other over these divisive issues?
I think I'm going to take your words and kind of putting ourselves in other people's shoes. And I think that would be important, not just when we're talking to scientists and non-scientists, but, you know, I think kind of talking about kind of thinking about policy, coming back to the excellent editorial that we mentioned earlier, you know, even though I did suggest like it becomes a little bit slippery, I do think in the end, it is vital that kind of scientists at some point draw a line and say, okay, there are other policy perspectives out there. And, you know, need to kind of acknowledge that and have conversations. If they want to engage in policy discussions, they need to recognize the consideration of alternative perspectives and kind of, again, put themselves in the shoes of those other people and kind of engage in those difficult conversations to have.
Yeah, and sometimes I just think being more explicit about what your policy proposal is and why. I mean, if you think about some of the things that were missteps in communicating around COVID, some of it had to do with not being clear about, you know, I'm saying this because I want to save the most number of lives, not because this is the best thing for you as an individual. That would maybe help people a little bit understand.
Yes, for sure. I think, transparent communication is, I think, emerged as an important thing that was not always the case in during COVID.
Yeah. And yes, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of a longer standing issue, but it comes up again recently. We're seeing new scholarship around this where there are these lingering, on the one hand, trust in science and scientists is higher than many other institutions. But on the other hand, there is an ongoing concern around transparency and accountability for scientists and science institutions. And maybe that is part of our, you know, where we think there is an appropriate level of questioning authority, and the two go together in our society now. Go ahead.
Yeah. Transparency is always a tricky issue. I think in communicating, it's important to be transparent. In the production of science, you know, transparency is obviously vital because it's part of the scientific norms that we kind of live under when we're kind of practicing scientists. It becomes difficult to communicate this the processes of science. The challenge is, people want to know how you arrived at that knowledge, but how do you go about communicating that? I think the challenge is you don't want to take trust as a given. I think that's clear. How do you go about establishing that trust? And there's in doing that, you need to put forth, various attributes, including competence, including benevolence, and including transparency. But kind of how far do you go before you kind of lose attention? I think that's it's a communication challenge for sure.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. We want that understanding of how it goes, how it works, but not in as much detail as sometimes we're given. And it's difficult to kind of earn that trust with finding the right balance there. Now, as I predicted, this went very quickly, so we need to kind of pull our final thoughts together. Jamie, is there anything we're missing that you wanted to talk about? And also, what's the one kind of takeaway you really hope people will remember from this conversation?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you again. It's been great. I think a takeaway is kind of two points. One is, again, as I started, there is a trust challenge for scientists. But I think when we discuss that trust challenge, we should think about it less in terms of kind of necessarily absolutely low trust of science, and more about kind of the way that trust is dividing the population. I think both are challenges. I don't mean to minimize kind of a lower trust as not being a problem. But I think at this moment, I think the kind of the political divides are really the perplexing ones. I think that a lot of what we saw during COVID were those political divides about science. And so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Again, not to dismiss, levels of trust as important, but I think divisions across certain populations and then political entities is of equal importance. A second point again is, I think it is always important to keep in mind that people are largely willing to trust science when scientists behave in kind of responsible manners. And so it is incumbent upon scientists to behave as responsible practitioners and researchers, and recognize too that citizen science is one source of information and not a defining dictum on how people should act. So I think, thinking about those divides and then thinking about kind of how scientists can go about kind of making sure science is some of the information that people draw upon, particularly when it is, a crucial part of decision-making as it was during COVID.
Love it. I love it. Yeah. So the last part of it being one source of information reminds me of what Alan Leshner, who was the past CEO of AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, used to say all the time: scientists need to be a little humble about the certainty of their findings and just about how they think about their role in this conversation. We've gotten a historical perspective from the Spanish flu to today. We've gotten the kind of big picture conversation about what's going on that I think we don't normally hear. So I really appreciate your thoughts and observations on this. Please, everyone, join me in thanking Jamie Druckman for a great conversation today. And I really appreciate everyone being here. If you want to recap later, there will be a video recording. So That will come up in the next couple of days at this link there. And you can also find us on a podcast if you look for or subscribe to Dialogue Across Difference. So thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll be back for the next event on April 2nd.
Thank you.